Hi, I'm Greg Mangum, founder and voluntary CEO of Only a Pavement Away. We're the charity that supports people looking to rebuild their lives through employment opportunities in hospitality. Welcome back to our podcast series, Serving Success. Today I'm joined by our patron and Michelin star chef, Tom Aitkins. I was going to say, and my good friend, but he might say, hang on a minute, when did that happen?
Good morning or afternoon, wherever we're at.
Yeah. So we'll get started on this. I've got some questions for Tom, so you, the listeners, can get a really good picture. Firstly, Tom, can you give our listeners some backstory into your career and how you got to where you are today? I mean, I heard it at an event.
You probably heard it a few times.
It's fascinating, yeah.
You're probably like, oh, here we go again. So, no, I decided on becoming a chef when I was very young, literally at the age of 11. And reason being, I grew up in the county of Norfolk. And where we lived, we were just on the border sort of we're near the Norwich city, but also on the verge of the countryside as well. So we had quite a big garden, and a large part of that was taken over by my mother's vegetable garden. So she was a very, very keen gardener. And probably from the age of like 5 or 6, she made us sort of started to work in the sort of garden with her, doing weeding and picking and seeding and everything. And we actually quite enjoyed it. It wasn't like, you know, a chore or anything like that. And as we sort of, you know, progressed through the year, because she basically, you know, grew everything all year round, spring, summer, autumn, winter. So we kind of understood at a very early age what seasonality was and how things grew and everything. And having, you know, really tasty food on the table was also a great advantage of growing all your own vegetables. And eventually, probably by the age of, you know, 8 or 9, we then started doing our own vegetables, growing our own, seeding our own, picking, etc. That then slowly progressed into the kitchen, and, you know, digging up all the vegetables and then preparing them in the kitchen and then cooking them with my mother. And the first taste of something I still remember of, you know, of picking something from the garden and really noticing, you know, a big difference in something that was freshly picked is the flavour and the taste. And one of the, you know, the best things to highlight that was potatoes, because once you get something that's so sort of earthy and natural, and you have it straight away, literally out of the ground, and you've cooked it in half an hour, the taste is just amazing, you know, with a bit of garden mint and butter and, oh, delicious. And then my father, he was in the wine business, so he had a retail shop, and then he also had an importing, exporting company where he imported wine from France and obviously, yeah, sold that in his shop. But then he was also doing a lot of business with some of the supermarket chains. And basically we then, as a family, started going to France as well on holidays and half term. And so, you know, he would then take us, you know, to some fun meetings. We would just tag along and he would like say, oh, I've got my sons here. Can we, you know, give them something to do? So he would like, you know, we'd wander off into the vineyards or into the cellars, like sweeping cellars or picking grapes or whatever, and we would sometimes go, you know, to some of these lunch meetings with them as well. So we kind of got at an early age as well kind of a taste for good food and French cooking as well. And by the age of 11, we had then decided to become chefs. Literally me and my brother had said, oh, what should we do, you know? And we kind of liked the cooking and the sort of, you know, tasting French food, and that was it. And then when I was 11, I then, knowing that I was going to be leaving primary school literally the next year, I then called up the college pretending to be a school leaver. So I'm jumping forward another 5 years. I put on a sort of in reasonably sort of deep and husky voice saying, you know, I've just left school. Ha-ha, still had to go. You know, what qualifications do I need? You don't need any qualifications. Just come for an entrance exam. And if we like you, we'll take you. This was then, you know, sort of 1982. And I obviously hadn't included the 5 years that I was supposed to do at school. But it would have been 86 that I started. Anyway, so I then told my brother this. And we were like both quite ecstatic that we didn't have to do any revision or exams or anything like that. So we went to school, wasted 5 years of our time because we just messed around. And then at the end of it, yeah, we went to catering college. And then after that, we then stayed there for 2 years. And then I came to London and started from the very bottom and slowly worked all the way up to the top, working with different Michelin star chefs. I also went to work in France. So it was a long road and, you know, a lot of hard work, that was for sure, but a lot of fun as well.
But I think it's worth saying to people out there that want to become a Michelin star chef and everything that you've achieved and you're a claimer for, is that you also went to France, didn't you? And you did some pretty long hours in France, I remember you saying to me.
Yes, I did. Well, I was lucky, the fact that people that I worked with when I was in London, he had worked at this restaurant previously called Gilles Robuchon, which had 3 stars in the Michelin. He's now sadly passed away a few years ago. But I went there, you know, sort of, I was probably then still young. Well, I was very young. I was 24 years old. And I'd known that it was going to be tough. And because I had worked in mainly French restaurants in London with French chefs, I already spoke French anyway pretty fluently, and through obviously being in France with my father and everything, I picked it up. And all the terminology in the kitchens was in French anyway, so it's fairly easy to, you know, to understand. But it was the hours that were quite long. And not that anyone is doing these hours anymore, that's for sure. But I was, you know, living 40 minutes away anyway, which was quite a long way away, in Place de République, which is near Gare du Nord. So I was having to travel like 45 minutes to work. I was getting up at 4:45 in the morning. And then I would work all the way through until 4:00 in the afternoon. I would then have, you know, we'd have like a 15-minute break, go and get some ice cream or something to get some, you know, sugar in us. And then be back in the kitchen and work again until, you know, 1:00 in the morning, because you'd be cleaning and everything. And then I'd be home by, you know, 1:45, and then up again at 4:45.
Amazing. So I suppose the big question is that if you hadn't become a chef, what would you be doing now? What was the alternative?
So the alternative would have been a jockey.
Really?
Yes, because I have Irish family, as one does, who live in Tipperary in Ireland. The family there is, they're all into horses and everything. Well, one of them was a very, very good professional jockey called Charlie Swan. He won the Cheltenham Gold Cup 3 times. On the same horse, Istabrak. And I, as a child, we would go there. And it's funny because there's all these horses, loads of horses. And we would just ride the horses, you know, around the yard or fields just as a fun thing. And in my mid-30s, I kind of said to my uncle, it'd be nice to be able to ride properly and to learn. He says, oh, well, why don't you come over for a week and to learn to ride properly. He said, I'll take you and I'll teach you and whatever. I basically started from, you know, from ground zero, literally nothing. We built it up fairly quickly because he said, look, if it's in the genes, it's in the genes. And I think it is, you know, so it can just like get you going fairly quickly. Anyway, so in the space of 5 days, we were running on the indoor arena. It was pretty, you know, pretty intense stuff. And I was like, whoa, stiff as hell. On the last day, he goes, so tomorrow morning, you're going to have a surprise. Never trust an Irishman. When they say you're going to have a surprise in the morning, I'm just like, okay. Anyway, so he says, come down a little bit earlier. So I came down at 7 into the yard, and all the jockeys had already been out. And I see him in the corner. He's pulling this horse out of the stable. I'm like, oh my God, is that my horse? And this horse is like jarring and yanking his head. And he pulls it over, and I go to him, my, that's a bit of a spirited horse there. He says, yeah, don't you worry there, Tom. You'll be fine. Anyway, so I'm like, my God, this horse is like crazy. I could see his eyes were like bulging out of his head and his ears were pricked up. And then my uncle goes to me. He says, oh, we're going to give you another surprise. I said, well, what's that? He says, oh, we're going to give you proper racing saddle and stirrups. So I'm on this horse, short saddle, stirrups, my knees around my bloody head. I get on this horse. And then he goes, right, all you got to do is keep them reins nice and sharp. Just keep them sharp. And I'm like, okay. And he says, when you leave the yard, you just follow this wood chip path. He's pointing at this path. And he says, it goes through the forest. As soon as you get out of the forest, you'll get a clearing, and then you're on the gallops. Anyway, so I get on this horse. I've got my reins nice and short. And I'm going on the wood chip path through the forest. And then, bam, this horse has gone, like, flying. Literally flying. And I'm on the horse, and my uncle is driving by the side of me in this battered old Land Rover, laughing his head off, going, are you right there, Tom? You're having a lot of fun, are you? And thank God, I'm like, you know, fully decked out. This horse just would not slow down. And I was pulling and pulling and pulling. This thing just did not stop. And I couldn't see anything, literally. And I did not want to let go of the reins to wipe the mud off, because I just was scared that I was going to fall off. Anyway, so that was my, yeah, extreme kind of, but it was the biggest adrenaline rush I have ever experienced. It was amazing. Yeah,
I think that's it. At least you got an exciting one. I mean, I decided I was going to leave Hospitality, I worked in a jeweller's and sort of lasted 3 days because putting little watches in a window didn't do me. I think once you're in hospitality, you're in hospitality. Smuggle a few diamonds, yeah. So you've been our patron for many years now.
Yes.
What made you get involved? I mean, God, it was COVID, wasn't it?
It was COVID, yes. Because we were in hospitality, as you know, kind of suddenly told to stop everything, kind of like, okay, so what do we do for the next, you know, the next few months? And I thought, okay, well, if we're going to have quite a bit of time on our hand, what does one do? And at that point, kind of was already working with a couple of charities anyway, sort of one was cancer and one was sort of with children's charities. And I kind of thought, well, if I'm going to have this amount of time off, I should at least, you know, try and do something, I think, within hospitality. Only a Pavement Away popped up. And I think Laura probably shot you an email of saying how I can be involved and, you know, he's going to have quite a bit of time on his hand and, you know, why don't you use him and see what, you know, see what will come out of it.
Yeah.
And there we go.
And I think what you don't know is I remember when I got the phone call from Laura and the first time I spoke to you, I then went in and said to Jill, we've got Tom Aitkins. Mm. He's going to join us as sort of our main ambassador. And it's had a, oh my God, she said, have you read about this guy? She said, he's a Michelin star chef. He's got Muse Restaurants. She said, how did you do that? I said, no. I said,
Greg.
I said, I think he's found me walking along the street. Yeah, I felt sorry for me. So any of our people that you've met, any of our members that stand out? I know you've worked with one or two of them.
Obviously, you know, your amazing self, that's for sure. The cook and dine experience has been a lot of fun, and I think, you know, through the course of many years of doing it, there's definitely been a lot of really good characters there, and I think, you know, some that have either been volunteers, but then those that have come through the charity, like Paul, who came, I think, was a year or so ago that he came and worked in the kitchen, and just to see someone, you know, that had come through charity and being in now trained up and working in the kitchen environment with me is very humbling, even for myself, because I think, you know, when you have someone like that who come from a very, very difficult background with not really much hope there, seeing what the charity has done to someone like that and given them opportunity and put them back on their feet is very heartwarming. There is, as I said, hope for everyone.
Mm. And I think without embarrassing you, what happened when with Paul, a couple of the guys who have come out of the custodial system, is I think when they met you, their comments to me afterwards were that they were quite taken back, and then they expect you to meet a top chef and be shouted at and sort of just wash the pots and pans. And they said, no, we've come out knowing it's about pride, perfection, skills, and that self-belief. And I think, you know, they came in there and it was just like, and again, don't want to embarrass you, but one of them said to me, it was like watching an artist at work. Even at Cook and Dine, 350 meals pushed out with only one person in the kitchen, Tom, who knew what he was doing, you know. So on to Cook and Dine, it's our big fundraiser, 350 people. I think when we first met, I told you it was going to be 60.
I didn't believe you then, so yeah.
What does it mean to you personally?
Some point in your life when you can give more and you can give back, I think it's just such a nice way to, you know, to help people. And I think there is a stage, get a little bit more organized and things that you can, you know, really help people. And I think it's just such a nice way to do that with a charity like Only a Pavement Away. The Cook and Dine experience is, it's a great way to raise funds for the charity, but also to make it, I think, more broader and think in a sense of the marketing side of it and putting it out there and letting people really understand what it's all about, you know, a fun challenge. And I think it's a great way, as I said, to really endorse the charity and really to make such a special event of it.
Yeah, and I think what's interesting is that there's one or two chief execs out there who have said to their PAs, can you get the date from Cook and Dine before you book anything in for September? Because I want to do that. And there's one very large pub company out there that's having to rotate its board, because some new board members are saying, but we haven't had a chance to do that.
That's hilarious.
So we want to do it. And, you know, if I send out an email the day after, you know, do you want to volunteer for next year?
Yeah.
Everybody comes back. So what's it like behind the scenes? Because people sort of say, oh, it must be this well-run machine. I know that one guy last year was over the moon because he sort of said, he was talking to another guy, he said, oh, I messed the sauce up. Another one said, oh, no. I've got told off twice. Tom's told me off twice. And this, they were going for a drink and a badge of honour that they'd
Yeah, well, you know, I still run a tight ship, whether, you know, it's with, you know, doing 350 or doing 30. So it's funny because, like, you're going from doing all the prep, which is great, into then the service time, which is just a whole nother level of the unknown because you don't know really how it's going to go. I always choose a cold starter or soup just to make it that little bit easier. But then there's no getting around the main course. The main course is, you know, the main course. And we try to set it up where there's a kind of a chain reaction of, okay, we do one garnish, two garnish, three garnish, and then protein and sauce, and then it's gone. But it kind of takes around 50 plates to go and to get into a routine. So the first 50 are a little bit arms crossing over, plates crossing over, people are in the way, and then you kind of have to keep them in order because otherwise it just, you know, the wheels are going to fall off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I know we're back at the Waldorf again.
Yes.
This year, we're extremely generous to us. And you personally, you love a challenge. I know we got you involved on the, and I have to tell the listeners, is the first year we did the static bike ride for hospitality ride.
Yes.
We didn't realise what a keen cyclist you were. And I think you went first and you upped the level of the bike, went back to the restaurant and everybody else was like, oh,
yeah,
this is really hard work. And then someone said, hold on a minute. Someone's adjusted the speed and the gears. I mean, I think Tom has put it to his natural speed. But the other challenge you did was Kilimanjaro.
I did, yes.
Raised £60,000 for us, which is phenomenal.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what was it like?
It was great. I mean, I enjoyed it a lot. I had done necessary training, but sadly I got altitude sickness at just around 4,000 metres. And so every time you do a full day's walk, you then, you know, are at your camp where you have a tent and then you have like a mess tent and you go and have your food and whatever. And so there is quite a bit of time on your hand because you set off reasonably early after breakfast. And then after that, you know, you kind of then walking from, you know, sort of around sort of 8 till 2 o'clock in the afternoon. So we always try to make lunchtime in the camp. So around like, 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock. And it's funny because you go through very, very different scenery because the very offset, you know, it's kind of quite lush forests and greenery and misty and monkeys and everything, and then you're just on this little sort of earth path that kind of takes you up and up and up, and as you pass through the different sceneries, obviously you're increasing the level of altitude that you're actually climbing, and it's very actually steady. It's not like, you know, it's not like a steep hill. It's a very, very sort of probably like 7-6% incline, so it's you know, it's gentle. And at base camp, when you're there, for me, it's quite difficult because there's nothing to do. So for a chef to say, oh, yeah, no, you can go and sit down and do nothing, it's quite hard, you know. I'm like, I read a book and chill out and, you know, and that's it. So it's quite fun, you know, not to be able to do anything. And, of course, there's absolutely no Wi-Fi, so you're not going to be able to do any emails or anything like that. So I kind of like, oh, this is interesting. not done this in a while. Anyway, so then you progress and you go on, and then, you know, because basically what happens, you cannot see at all the top of Kilimanjaro because you're kind of, you know, in the forest, and then you're a different sort of undulating landscape, which is up and down. And then on the last bit, you kind of then get to see, you know, a bit more of what is coming. And then you're suddenly like, oh my God, you know, it's kind of quite big. And at that point, the company that I was doing it with, Walking My Bear, you know, were very good because Jonathan Kattenberg, who was running it, he was very sort of into doing checkups and making sure that everyone was, you know, was safe. And obviously safety is paramount on the mountain because in terms of what can happen to you, because there are three things that you have to be conscious of all the time. Obviously, yes, the altitude, but in terms of, you know, you take your pulse and your oxygen level, and then you just, you know, things change when you get up there because you can also get, in terms of the altitude sickness, you can get swollen sort of stomach, because basically what happens is all your organs, everything slows down when you go higher. Interesting for a chef, like, you know, when you're eating, because your digestion takes that much longer, your food goes down to your stomach, starts to ferment, so you then get this sort of really uneasy build up of gas. So there's lots of farting and lots of burping going on, that's for sure. And that's just one of the side effects that you get, you know, is a build up of gas. And then the other one is your blood oxygen level can decrease as well. So for just to give you the landscape of where I was at, normal blood oxygen level should be around 90%. And it's funny because I had one of these readers and I was looking at this, you know, even before I was going, and it said, if it goes anywhere below 90%, you should immediately call 191 or whatever it is, you know, for emergency services, get straight to hospital. So I was like, okay. And I kind of was reading all this, you know, before I went. I noticed on the last camp that I was getting, like, quite, you know, quite gassy and what have you. And I was doing lots of burps and everything else as well. And coming into camp, it was, I kind of noticed that I was just, my stomach had swollen a little bit as well. And I was feeling a little bit tired and, you know, like, again, side effect is, you know, is tiredness and heaviness of legs and everything and a few yawns here and there and what have you. Anyway, so Jonathan said, you know, let's just everyone go to their camp, sort out their bed and everything, which you always did. And I just noticed it took a little bit longer to, you know, kind of get everything out and get organised and what have you. So he said, look, come to the camp, let's tent at 2 and we'll have eat and see how you are and do all the vital readings. And anyway, first time I wasn't really that hungry. Before I was like wolfing down the food, and the food was really good, I have to say. Now I was just like, I wasn't that hungry, I wasn't that thirsty, and I was like, this is not good. And Jonathan said, you're not hungry, Tom. I said, yeah, I kind of lost my appetite. I said, okay. I said, that'll be fine. Let's just do your vital reading. So blood pressure was fine. Took my pulse. And the thing with me as well is because my blood circulation is not that great either. So my hands are quite cold, my feet are quite cold. And even to get like a reading or a pulse reading on my index finger was really, really tough. And then when I did, my blood oxygen had gone down to 80. And he was like, he wasn't worried at that point because he said, look, you know, you're fit and healthy, as I do know. And the thing is, what I have read into it now, that when you are fit and healthy, is actually, it's much tougher to go up to altitude. If you're not that fit, it's much easier. So I went back to my tent, and the thing was then, you know, I had eaten a little bit, and every time that I lied down, I would then get this like huge amount of like gas would come up. And it made you really queasy, like properly, like I felt like I was going to, you know, be sick. And I was like, oh my God. So I waited 10 minutes, opened the tent, got some fresh air, called over to Jonathan because he was in the next door tent. I said, Jonathan, you know, I'm struggling to, you know, to lie down even. He said, okay, well, let's just try and do another reading again. And my blood oxygen had gone down to 60%. He said, now this is quite strange. He said, because normally when people have 60%, they're either unconscious or they're practically dead. And it's funny because you're still talking, you're saying that you're fine. He says, yeah, I said, I'm feeling okay, I'm feeling fine. But he said, you know, we've got to get you off the mountain. So I then was chop it off. Literally, well, chop it off. I was literally like, I was frog march, literally had two bearers on either side of me, like lifting me down off the mountain because they're worried that I was going to collapse at any point or something. Because 60% is, and when I've told doctors here, they're like, what the hell? How, my God, like, how on earth did you manage to? Because you should be like out. And then, yeah, so I got choppered off. To say that was quite an experience because the views are amazing and you go through the clouds and whatever. So that whole experience was quite fun. I get off the helicopter, I'm in a car, and then it's over to the kind of, you know, these the organizers who obviously, so I then go to this hospital. I spend a couple of hours in the hospital doing tests and everything, and they're all fine. And then basically, I then get back to the hotel. I'm in a different hotel, and they then tell me, funnily enough, we put you on the fifth floor or the sixth floor, but the lifts are not working. I was just like, oh great! And this is when it really hit home. Every floor, like I had to stop for like 5 minutes to catch my breath. I was literally, like, my legs had got heavy. I was like feeling like really like nauseous. And so I wasn't then in a particularly good spot. So I then had to wait before I could then, yeah, fly out again.
And you still brought in £60,000.
There we go, you know.
And is there another challenge on the horizon?
Well, the thing is, you know, I have been kicking myself whether or not to do it again, you know, regardless of obviously all of that. And when you hear, or when you've heard me saying, yeah, my blood oxygen was 60%, people will be saying, you're bloody mad. But, you know, it's you know, I like challenges. I've never not failed, to be honest, you know. So I don't know. I mean, I may, you know, contemplate on doing it again. I'm having various tests and things done now to see what can be done. So, yeah, watch this space. Let's see.
Yeah, so, I mean, if it happens, it happens.
Yeah, exactly.
You don't run, do you? Do you run, or...?
I used to run a lot, yes. Say, between my 40s and 50s, yeah, I ran considerably quite a lot. I was probably, like, you know, Forrest Gump, a little bit like that. So, yeah, done it.
And what's next for Tom Atkins? I mean, we've got Muse. I know you've done... Yeah. Then been in the Maldives doing a guest season there,
which is very, very nice. Perks of the job. We all like the perks occasionally. You know, they're quite nice. I've got, you know, some travels on the way this year because I'm doing quite a lot of collaborations with some interesting chefs. So I've been doing them at Muse called Culinary Creators. So it's just celebrating those that are in the industry and doing nice, fun collaborations with them. And then I'm then doing four that are outside of the UK as well. So I'm doing one very soon in Iceland with Agnar Sverrisson, who used to work with me at the Blue Lagoon. He has a one star there. I'm then going to Rio in April as well with a chef called Alberto Langraf, who has a two star there. And then I'm also then going to Korea, another two star chef who worked with me before. And then one in Portugal, in Lisbon at the end of September. And then throughout the year, as I said, these culinary creators, we're doing one a month, so you can look at it online if you would like to come and book a table. Yeah.
Oh, and that be at Muse?
That's at Muse, yeah.
Well.
Yeah. So busy.
Busy. And some quick-fire questions. Favourite meal to order at a restaurant? People must, when you walk in the door and say, I'm coming for dinner, must, oh my God.
Some do, some don't, but I'm, you know, I'm very chill, very relaxed. I don't, you know, I have no airs and graces, probably, as you know, Greg, and I'm very happy with, you know, baked beans on toast or a super elaborative meal. But my thing most that I would probably order at a restaurant is, you know, if I'm going out, I do like a good steak and chips, I have to say. Yeah.
And I think just going back quickly when you sort of, that was the main thing when you and I first met and we hit it off, was I remember you said to me, it's not about me, Tom Atkins. It's about Only a Payment Away.
Yes.
Exactly. What can I do to help other people? And I think that's just epitomises the culture of Only a Payment Away and totally why we love having you as a patron. So what's the family's favourite meal for you to cook at home?
Well, I would say, well, I know what it is for my kids because they definitely have a more of a sweet tooth than a savoury tooth. So on the weekend, I might treat them to pancakes or waffles. Although this weekend, I actually made homemade donuts for them in a little bit of cinnamon sugar. And then the ones that were left over, I dipped them in hot icing. So they had those for school this morning.
Wow.
Yeah, lucky them.
You and your wife?
Roast chicken. Just a nice old roast chicken. Yeah.
And I have to go back. It's interesting you say steak. Because when we did the 5-Minute Feast, the cookbook that raised about £15,000 for us, I remember I did steak, but I think you left that out of the cookbook because I burnt my neighbour's fence down at the time reasons. Off the barbecue. There were certain reasons.
I think
reasons.
The barbecue was nearly on fire, and you know, I don't know if the skill in the plating was there.
It definitely wasn't. And you can't include me in this question, but if you could have dinner with any figure, past or present, who would it be and why?
It's a tough one. Listen, I'm very much into sport, that's for sure. I love my sport. And I think if there was anyone, you know, that has kind of been at the top of their game and has been a pinnacle in ways of everything would be someone like Muhammad Ali, because I think he's just one of those iconic sports people that, you know, that have been in the limelight for years. And then even when he retired from boxing, you know, was a spokesperson for, you know, for many things as well.
Mm. This would impress you. I served him when he was when he stayed at the Hilton in Park Lane.
Did he know?
Yeah, when I come out of
cooking, you're just serving.
No, I was just serving. I come out of catering college. I was a commie. I say this to everyone, so this is before I got my first verbal warning of my career for eating the strawberry tartlets behind the dumb waiter.
Was that like 1 week into the job?
I was about 1 day into the job, I think. Yeah. They kept me on that. They saw development and allowed me to serve Muhammad Ali.
How funny.
But, Tom, thank you so much. And thank Absolute you for all pleasure. You do. We'd like to thank our sponsors for this.
Who Always are need them.
Stonegate Pub Company. Good old David McDowell, the CEO there, never forgets us. And he sponsors the whole of this podcast series, as he has done for the past 2 years. And
thank
he's
you.
A big sponsor of Cook and Dine as well.
Perfect. Thank you very much.
Thank you.